Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. And wow, today we are tackling a really challenging book. It's called Ethics and Theology After Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And I know
heavy stuff.
It's heavy stuff, right? Ethics, theology, Holocaust. We're really going deep here, but so relevant even today. So get ready to explore some really tough questions with us today.
Absolutely.
Like, can we actually learn anything about ethics and theology from something as awful as the Holocaust?
Yeah.
I mean, did this event completely shatter, like, how we even understand good and evil? Forgiveness?
For sure.
God, even?
I mean,
it forced a reckoning.
Yeah.
And that's what this book is wrestling with.
Yeah, definitely. I think the most common reaction to the Holocaust is just to call the perpetrators monsters, right?
Right.
Just pure evil.
Yeah, the book calls that the diabolization paradigm.
Okay.
And it's natural, you know, to distance ourselves from something so horrific.
For sure.
But the book argues that this view, while understandable, is actually too simplistic.
Too simplistic? How so? Well, think about it this way. Imagine a horrific torture machine.
Okay.
Like something out of Kafka's In the Penal Colony.
Okay.
If we only focus on the individual evil of the person operating that machine, you know?
Right.
We miss the entire system that created and supports that machine in the first place.
So you're saying that even though the Nazis were undeniably evil, just focusing on individual evil misses the bigger picture.
Exactly. And you see, true ethics can't exist in isolation.
Right.
And that brings us to the second paradigm that the book explores, which is the banality of evil.
Okay.
This comes from Hannah Arendt.
Right.
When she was analyzing Adolf Eichmann.
Oh, yeah.
She was a high-ranking Nazi official.
Right.
And she argued that modern bureaucracy and technology can actually distance individuals from the consequences of their actions.
It's like you get so caught up in the paperwork, you know, the processes.
Right.
That you just kind of lose sight of the human impact.
Exactly. And that makes even the most horrific acts seem routine, almost banal.
Yeah, that's scary. If you really think about it.
Right.
But doesn't that kind of let the Nazis off the hook a little bit? Because it makes it sound like they were just following orders and not really responsible.
That's a valid concern.
Yeah.
And the book does acknowledge that criticism of Arendt's work.
Okay.
It argues that we can't ignore the perpetrator's agency.
Okay.
They weren't just cogs in a machine.
Right.
They were active participants who chose to believe in and carry out a horrific ideology.
Right. So it's not just about individual evil or a faceless system. It's like there's something else.
There's a deeper, more disturbing layer.
Yeah.
And this leads us to the most unsettling paradigm, the Nazi ethic.
Okay.
The book digs into the work of scholar Peter Haas.
Okay.
Who argues that the Nazis actually created a warped but coherent ethical system.
Wait, a Nazi ethic?
Yeah.
Are you saying that genocide can be ethical?
No, absolutely not. The book strongly disagrees with Haas on that point.
Okay.
But what's fascinating here is the idea that the Nazis might have used this so-called Nazi ethic to mask their own self-deception.
So even if they convinced themselves it was right, on some level they had to know it was wrong.
Right. They were twisting good to serve their own evil ends.
That's so disturbing.
It is.
It's like a Pandora's box.
Right.
Of, like you said, self-deception.
Yeah.
Ideology.
The power of ideology.
Good and evil.
The nature of good and evil.
Yeah, we've gone from monsters to banal bureaucrats to like a warped system of ethics.
Yeah.
Masking a deeper self-deception.
And that's just looking at the perpetrators.
Right. We haven't even talked about the victims.
Right.
Did ethics even exist in a place like Auschwitz?
Yeah.
Like, how could anyone make ethical choices in those circumstances?
That's where it gets really thought-provoking.
Yeah.
The book challenges the assumption that the camps were purely spaces of amorality.
Right.
Instead, it highlights how even in Auschwitz, victims showed incredible resilience and made ethical choices every day.
But how is that even possible? It's a place literally designed to strip people of their humanity.
Well, think about Viktor Frankl, the psychiatrist who survived Auschwitz.
Right.
His work emphasizes the importance of finding meaning even in the darkest of times.
Right.
And then Svetlana Todorova, another scholar, wrote about the daily virtues displayed by victims. Acts of courage, solidarity, even love.
Okay, so even amidst unimaginable suffering, there were glimpses of hope, you know, of humanity shining through. But it's also about survival, right?
Yeah.
How much free will did people really have?
The book acknowledges that.
Yeah.
The immense pressure victims faced and the impossible choices they had to make.
Yeah, it's easy for us sitting here, you know, to say what we would or wouldn't do.
Of course.
But none of us can truly know how we would react in that situation.
Yeah.
The point is just to recognize that even in the darkest of places, that human capacity for good.
For ethical action.
Yeah, for ethical action. Yeah. Could still exist.
Absolutely. And speaking of trying to understand,
yeah.
Jewish philosophers have really grappled with the theological implications of Auschwitz, raising profound questions about God, morality, and the relationship between the two.
Okay, this feels like a whole other level of deep. Who were some of these thinkers and what were their responses?
One prominent figure is Emmanuel Levinas.
Great.
He developed this concept of the face of the other,
yeah.
arguing that the foundation of ethics lies in our encounter with the vulnerability of another human being.
So it's not about some abstract principle. It's about a real lived experience
Precisely.
Of another person.
Yes. And for Levinas, God isn't some powerful figure in the sky.
Right.
God is revealed in our responsibility to the vulnerable.
Okay.
In the face of the other, it's a very radical rethinking of traditional theological concepts.
That's powerful. But how do we reconcile that idea with the Holocaust? Where that vulnerability was so brutally exploited?
That's a question that continues to haunt us.
Yeah.
The book also explores the work of Emil Falkenhayn.
Okay.
Another Jewish philosopher who famously said,
okay.
Jews are forbidden to grant Hitler posthumous victories.
Oh, what did he mean by that?
He meant affirming Jewish life and resisting despair.
Okay.
He developed a theology of resistance.
Okay.
Arguing that Jews have a duty to survive and thrive in the face of unimaginable evil.
So two very different responses. Both grappling with the profound implications of Auschwitz, are there any other perspectives we should consider?
Yes.
Well,
the book then brings in Zygmunt Bauman, who's a sociologist.
Okay.
And he offers a chilling analysis.
Okay.
He argues that the Holocaust wasn't just an aberration.
Right.
It was actually facilitated by the very structure of modern society.
Okay.
With its emphasis on efficiency, bureaucracy, and the dehumanization of individuals.
So if the Holocaust was a product of modernity, does that mean it could happen again?
Sobering thought.
Yeah, this has been a lot to unpack already.
Oh, I know.
We've only just scratched the surface.
Yeah, just the beginning.
We've explored the complex nature of the perpetrators, the incredible resilience of the victims, and how Jewish thinkers have grappled with the theological implications of Auschwitz. Where do we go from here?
Well, next, we'll delve into one of the most profound questions raised by the Holocaust.
Ooh, okay.
Is forgiveness even possible after something so horrific?
Man, that's a tough one.
It is.
All right. I think we all need to take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Get some water.
For sure.
And we'll come back for part two. Okay, I think we need to take a deep breath for a second.
Yeah.
This deep dive is already so intense, and we haven't even touched on one of the biggest questions. Forgiveness.
Right.
Is it even possible after the Holocaust?
Right.
I mean, how can you forgive something so utterly horrific?
That's a question that has haunted humanity for generations.
Right.
And this book really dives deep into the complexity of forgiveness.
Yeah.
Especially in the context of the Holocaust.
Right.
It's not a simple yes or no answer.
Right, because it's easy for us to sit here and say, oh, well, of course I could never forgive something like that. But we haven't walked in the shoes of the survivors.
Right.
Those who experienced that unimaginable horror firsthand.
Exactly. And the book reminds us that forgiveness is a deeply personal and yeah. multifaceted process. For sure. It challenges us to consider what forgiveness might actually mean after the Holocaust.
Right.
It's not about forgetting or condoning.
Right.
It's about finding a way to live with the past without being consumed by anger and hatred.
Because if we allow ourselves to be consumed by those negative emotions, haven't we let the perpetrators win in a way?
That's a very good point.
Like, haven't we let them poison our own hearts and minds?
The book suggests that true forgiveness requires a deep, honest confrontation with the nature of evil itself.
Wow.
We have to understand the complexities of human motivation.
Right.
The systemic factors that contribute to violence and oppression. It's not enough to just label people as monsters and move on.
So it's about recognizing that potential for darkness within all of us, within humanity itself. That's a much more challenging task than just pointing fingers and saying, well, they were evil, but we would never.
Exactly. You see, confronting the Holocaust in a meaningful way means recognizing that capacity for evil within ourselves. And that recognition should fuel a commitment to ethical responsibility.
Yeah.
To actively fighting against injustice wherever we see it.
So the Holocaust becomes more than just a historical event. It becomes like a mirror.
Right.
Reflecting not just the horrors of the past, but the potential for darkness with it. Each of us.
Absolutely.
It forces us to examine our own values.
Our own choices.
Our own choices, yeah. And that leads us to one of the most fundamental questions of all. Where was God in Auschwitz?
Yeah, that's a question that has probably tormented theologians and individuals of faith for centuries.
Right.
How can we reconcile the idea of a loving, just God with the sheer scale of suffering and evil in the Holocaust?
Yeah, it's hard to wrap your head around any kind of theological explanation when you're faced with the systematic annihilation of millions of people.
Absolutely. The book grapples with this question head on.
Okay.
It explores how the Holocaust impacted theological thinking, particularly within Catholicism.
Okay.
It delves into those traditional attempts to explain God's goodness in the face of evil theodicies and how they kind of break down when confronted with Auschwitz.
Right.
It even introduces us to Richard Rubinstein, a Jewish theologian who reached a radical conclusion after Auschwitz: God is dead.
Wow. So for him, the Holocaust was so horrific, it just shattered his faith completely.
Right.
He saw it as evidence of God's absence or even non-existence.
That was his response. But the book also presents other theological approaches that try to wrestle with this tension between God's goodness and the reality of evil.
So it's not about offering easy answers or pat explanations. It's about acknowledging the depth of the struggle, the difficulty of making sense of such profound suffering.
Right.
It's about wrestling with these questions honestly and authentically.
Exactly. And it highlights how different thinkers have found ways to hold on to their faith.
Right.
Even in the face of unimaginable darkness.
Okay. But if we're going to be really honest with ourselves, isn't there a part of us that wants to shout, how could a loving God allow this to happen?
Right.
Where was the intervention, the protection?
That's a very raw, visceral response.
Yeah.
That a lot of people feel. The book explores different perspectives on this.
Okay.
Like the idea of God as a co-sufferer experiencing the pain and anguish of the Holocaust alongside the victims, or the concept of God as a moral protest against evil, a force that stands in opposition to the darkness even when it seems to be winning.
So even within a theological framework, there's no easy answer, no single unified response.
Right.
It's about wrestling with these difficult questions, searching for meaning in the midst of suffering.
That's the essence of faith for many people.
Right.
And the book itself takes a nuanced approach, drawing on the work of Thomas Aquinas, who saw evil as privatio boni, the absence of good.
Hold on, absence of good. How does that apply to the Holocaust?
It's about seeing evil not as some independent force, but as a distortion.
Okay.
A perversion of what should be in the context of the Holocaust.
Okay.
This idea helps us understand the role of fragmentation, self-deception,
right,
and the twisting of good intentions to serve evil ends.
Okay, that's a really interesting way to think about it. It's not about denying the reality of evil, but about understanding its roots, its nature.
Precisely. And this leads us back to the perpetrators.
Okay.
Remember how we talked about the book pushing back against the idea of them as simply monsters?
Right. And it also challenged the idea that they were just mindless bureaucrats following orders.
Exactly. The book suggests that the perpetrators engaged in a profound level of self-deception.
Wow.
Using a warped ideology, this so-called Nazi ethic, to mask their own bad faith.
Oh,
they had to convince themselves that what they were doing was good,
right,
necessary,
right,
even righteous in order to carry it out.
So it's about understanding the psychology of evil, the way individuals can rationalize and justify even the most horrific actions.
Exactly. And this raises profound questions about the nature of free will, the role of ideology in shaping our beliefs, and the very human capacity for self-deception.
Wow. This conversation has taken us to some very dark places.
Yeah.
But it's also shedding light on some really important truths about humanity.
That's the power of engaging with difficult questions.
Yeah.
And it's especially important when we're talking about something as significant as the Holocaust. It's not just a historical event.
Right.
It's a challenge to our understanding of ourselves, our world, and our place in it.
Okay, so we've explored the complexities of forgiveness, the theological fallout of Auschwitz, and the unsettling psychology of evil. But what about the victims?
Right.
How do they fit into this larger conversation?
The book emphasizes the importance of listening to the voices of survivors, of honoring their experiences and perspectives.
For sure.
Their stories remind us of the human cost of hatred and indifference, and they challenge us to never forget what happened.
Right, because it's easy to get caught up in these abstract ideas and theological debates, but we can't lose sight of the individual human beings whose lives were shattered by the Holocaust.
And their resilience, their courage,
right,
their acts of kindness and compassion, even in the darkest of times, offer a powerful counterpoint to the darkness we've been exploring.
Yeah, it's a reminder that even in the face of unimaginable evil, the human spirit can endure.
Exactly. And it's a testament to the enduring power of hope.
This has been incredibly heavy, but also incredibly enlightening.
Yeah.
I feel like we need to pause here.
I agree.
To process everything we've discussed so far.
This material deserves careful reflection.
Yeah, we'll pick up this deep dive in the next part, exploring even more of the challenges and insights presented in this profound book. Okay, we're back for the final part of our deep dive into ethics and theology after Auschwitz. And, you know, this book has really pushed me to think in ways I haven't before, especially when it comes to the idea of Christianity after the Holocaust.
Yeah, that's a crucial thread that the book picks up, especially given the tragic history of Christian anti-Semitism, which undeniably played a role in creating the conditions for the Holocaust.
Right. It makes you question so much of what's been considered traditional Christian theology. You know, especially when you think about how much emphasis there's been on Jesus replacing the Jewish covenant.
Right.
That becomes really problematic after Auschwitz, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And the book introduces this idea of a post-Holocaust Christology, a new way of understanding Jesus that fully recognizes the ongoing validity of Judaism.
Okay.
It sees the Jewish no to Jesus not as something to be overcome,
right,
but as a legitimate theological position in its own right.
So it's not about trying to convert or supersede Judaism, but about finding a way for these two faiths to exist alongside each other, respecting each other's beliefs.
Exactly. One way the book suggests doing this is through what it calls Logos Christology.
Okay.
This approach focuses on the shared foundation of both Judaism and Christianity in the Word of God.
So it's about emphasizing the commonalities, the shared roots, rather than getting hung up on the differences.
Right. It's a powerful way to move past that old idea of supersessionism, where Christianity is seen as replacing or fulfilling Judaism, and it encourages a more respectful and meaningful dialogue between the two faiths.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But what about the Bible itself? I mean, there are passages, especially in the New Testament, that have historically been used to justify anti-Semitism.
Right.
How do we deal with those texts after the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Can they even still be considered sacred?
Those are tough questions, and the book delves into the challenges of biblical interpretation in a post-Holocaust world.
Okay.
It encourages what's called resistant reading.
Okay.
A way of approaching the text that recognizes the human limitations of the authors and the potential for misinterpretations and distortions.
So it's about reading the Bible with a critical eye, understanding the historical context, and challenging those interpretations that have been used to justify harmful actions.
It's about engaging with the text responsibly. The book also suggests a normativity of the future approach.
Okay.
This means we should interpret the Bible in a way that promotes justice, peace, and the flourishing of all people.
It's about using the Bible as a tool for good.
Yes.
For creating a more just and compassionate world rather than as a weapon to harm others.
Yeah.
Which makes me think about another aspect of theology that's often debated, how we view nature, the environment.
Right.
Has the Holocaust impacted that conversation at all?
It certainly has. The book explores the idea of a post-Holocaust theology of creation.
Okay.
It challenges that traditional view of nature as subservient to humanity.
Right.
A view that has been used to justify all sorts of environmental destruction.
Right. The idea that we have dominion over nature has led to some pretty disastrous consequences. But how does the Holocaust factor into this?
Well, the book contrasts this traditional view with Richard Rubinstein's perspective, which sees nature as a divine force in its own right, and it highlights the potential dangers of such a view.
Okay.
Especially how it can echo certain aspects of Nazi ideology.
So we have to be careful about elevating nature too much, lest we fall into those same patterns of thinking that led to the Holocaust.
Exactly. The book advocates for something it calls ethically qualified anthropocentrism.
Okay.
It's a mouthful, I know.
Yeah.
But it essentially means recognizing the unique role humans play in caring for creation while acknowledging our interdependence with the natural world.
So it's not about seeing ourselves as separate from nature or as its masters, but as responsible stewards.
That's the key takeaway. It's about recognizing the interconnectedness of all things and acting accordingly.
All of this leads to a really important question. How do we keep the memory of the Holocaust alive?
Right.
As time goes on, as eyewitnesses pass away, how do we prevent it from fading into just another chapter in a history book?
The book tackles this challenge of Holocaust education, acknowledging the dangers of something called Holocaust fatigue.
Oh, yeah.
That sense of desensitization that can set in when we're constantly bombarded with images and stories of suffering.
Right. It's like our empathy muscles get tired.
Exactly.
We can only process so much horror before we start to shut down.
Exactly. And the book stresses the importance of finding ways to make the Holocaust relevant to younger generations. It's not about simply reciting facts and figures. It's about making those emotional and ethical connections.
So it's about finding ways to bring the Holocaust to life, to connect it to contemporary issues.
Yes.
And to show how the same dynamics of prejudice, discrimination, and dehumanization are still at play in the world today.
Precisely. And it's not just about education.
Yeah.
It's about action.
Right.
It's about taking those lessons from the past and applying them to the present, to our own lives, to the choices we make every day.
This brings us to a really sensitive topic, one that the book doesn't shy away from, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Right.
It's tricky territory.
It is.
And I'm curious how the book navigates those waters.
The book acknowledges the profound impact of the Holocaust on Jewish identity and their understanding of security.
Right.
And it affirms the historical and theological legitimacy of Jewish claims to the land of Israel.
Okay.
But it also cautions against using the Holocaust to justify any and all actions taken by Israel.
Right, because we can't use the suffering of the past to justify suffering in the present.
Exactly.
That kind of thinking is dangerous and ultimately counterproductive.
The book advocates for a stance it calls multi-directed partiality.
Okay.
A way of approaching the conflict that recognizes the humanity and legitimate concerns of both Israelis and Palestinians.
So it's about trying to understand the complexities of the situation, the historical context, the lived experiences of both sides.
Exactly. And it's about rejecting simplistic narratives and those us versus them mentalities that only perpetuate the cycle of violence.
It's a call for empathy, for understanding, and for a willingness to engage in difficult conversations,
mm-hmm.
even when it's uncomfortable.
Precisely. And ultimately, it's about working towards a just and peaceful resolution.
Right.
That recognizes the rights and dignity of all involved.
Okay, wow. We've covered so much ground in this deep dive.
We have.
And I have to say, this book has been a real eye-opener.
Yeah.
It's challenged me to think critically.
Yeah.
To confront uncomfortable truths and to consider new ways of understanding the world.
It's not an easy read.
No.
But it's an important one. And the conversations, it sparks the questions it raises. Those are things we should all be grappling with.
Yeah, the Holocaust wasn't just a historical event. It was a watershed moment for humanity.
Right.
It forced us to confront the darkest depths of human nature, but it also revealed the resilience of the human spirit.
And the lessons we learned from the Holocaust, they're not just about the past, they're about the present and the future.
It's about recognizing the potential for both good and evil within ourselves and choosing to act in ways that promote justice, compassion, and understanding.
It's about never forgetting the victims and honoring their memory by working to create a world where such horrors can never happen again.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it sparked some reflection, some conversation, and maybe even some inspiration to make a difference in the world.